You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
John Banville's latest novel, Ancient Light, is the third in a trilogy that includes Eclipse and Shroud, all of which concern Alexander Cleve and his family. In this, Mr. Banville's 16th novel, he continues to explore the shifting nature of identity in a postmodern world and the relationship of memory to truth, all in a lyrical and playful style. He was awarded the Man Booker Prize in 2005 for his novel, The Sea. This one is published by Knopf. I'm very pleased it has brought Mr. Banville back to our show. Hello.
Hello, I'm very glad to be back.
Alexander Cleve, who narrates Ancient Light, is an aging actor recounting a lusty affair he had with Mrs. Gray, the mother of his best friend, when he was just 15. Some might call that statutory rape.
Yes, I suppose it is. I never thought about it. I'm glad to say I'm not a moralist and I'm not a professor of ethics. I just write about things as they are.
Well, is this a reverse Lolita story, your way of having fun with the critics who so often compare you to Nabokov?
It's funny, you know, somebody, when I handed it into my publisher, somebody mentioned that. It had never occurred to me. Hmm. But looking at it, of course, I suppose it probably is. Unconsciously, I was probably having fun with Nabokov.
Well, the work with its attention to telling details and emphasis on memory can be seen as Nabokovian, but haven't you said Nabokov was tone deaf?
Yes, I discovered there was always something odd about his prose, beautiful as it is. I always found there was something missing. And then I discovered it in an interview where he admitted that he was tone deaf, that he had no music in him at all.
Oh, that's what it literally is. Tone deaf.
Yeah, he's tone deaf. He just couldn't hear music. And there is no music in his prose. It's all pictorial. He said himself he should have been a painter.
This book has much to say about the nature of memory. Early on, Alex says, half the time he cannot tell whether images from the past are memories or inventions. And I'm assuming one of your ways of telling us he is an unreliable narrator.
Well, I don't know that there ever is a reliable narrator.
Well, some are more unreliable than
yes,
others.
Yes, I suppose so. But the past, it seems to me, the older I get, it seems to me the past doesn't actually exist in our memories. I think that we imagine more than remember. We make up things. And even neuroscientists now are saying that we model the world, that when we think we remember something, in fact, we're just remembering the model that we made of an experience.
And when you speak to two people who grow up in the same family and ask them about something that happened in the past, you get very different stories.
Yes,
even though they were both in the room at the same time.
Yeah, and even more simply, when you go back to somewhere you knew when you were young, and everything has shifted. You know, that door wasn't there and that window wasn't there. Everything shifted slightly. I think it's simply that the model has decayed in one's memory or one's imagination.
As a grown man, Alex reads a book whose style he describes as rhetorical in the extreme, dramatically elaborated, wholly unnatural, synthetic, and clotted. The same sort of thing that... You're having fun here, aren't you? This is the sort of thing that some of your detractors have said about
you. Yes, I handed that paragraph to the reviewers. You know, here, just print this verbatim. Yes, I had a lot of fun.
The book that Alex is reading is called The Invention of the Past, a biography of Axel Vander, a man who took another man's identity. And it's a reference to a character in an earlier novel of yours, Shroud, about a man named Axel Vander. And Alex is about to play the lead in a movie based on a biography that he's reading. So
yes, I'm quite proud of the intricate.
It's complicated.
I prefer to say intricate. Complicated is off-putting. Yes, I'm quite proud of it. It stands alone. You don't have to have read the previous books. But if you have read the previous books, you get little echoes and little jokes and little references. And, of course, the sad thing about Alex Cleve is that his daughter killed herself 10 years previously. And what he doesn't know is that she was involved with Axel Vander, the man whose part he's going to play in this movie. So he's certainly unreliable to that extent, that we know things that he doesn't know. But I had a lot of fun with that plot.
Well, you'll be keeping a lot of graduate students busy for quite a while, especially since the author of the book that he's reading is named J.B., John Banville's initials. Wasn't Vander based on Paul de Man, the Belgian-born deconstructionist who wrote anti-Semitic articles that were only discovered after his death?
Yes, to some extent, he's based on Paul de Man. Paul de Man was a fascinating figure. He abandoned his life in Europe, came to America, became a very, very highly respected professor at Yale. But it was then discovered that he'd written some anti-Semitic articles for a collaborationist Belgian newspaper during the war. And this made his work far more interesting, suddenly, because his work is all about evasiveness, the author's evasiveness, and the way that authors say one thing and mean another. So he was, in a way, talking about himself.
Well, all of the characters in this book seem to have at least one doppelganger. Even the name Cleve means two things. So you have Paul de Man with two personalities, really. And you have written books under the pseudonym Benjamin Black. You were even here to talk about one of those books. So that this is something, obviously, you're really interested in. I could go on. Alex refers frequently to literary and mythological figures. Mrs. Gray is Scheherazade, Penelope. He himself is Crusoe and Theseus.
Yes, I seem to live a doubled life, all right. I'm not aware of that. I don't set out to write about doubled characters, but I do. So it must be very deeply ingrained in me. But, you know, I wouldn't want to give the impression that this is a clever, clever book, you know, aimed at graduate students. This is a book for people to read. I'm not saying this because I want to increase sales, but I don't want it to seem sterile and merely playful. It is, I hope it's passionate, and it's, you know, it's filled with warm, erotic memories of this boyhood affair, but it's also filled with deep grieving for his dead daughter. It's meant to be about life, as all art is, not about itself.
And there's a philosophical argument at the heart of it between romanticism and something more modern, like deconstructionism.
Yes, I suppose there is. I hadn't really thought of that. I always like coming on your show, because you always tell me something about the book that I didn't know.
Well, that's very kind. But Alex, here we have Alex describing deconstruction as arcane and coded specialism. He refers to a professor in post-punk studies, but certainly some ideas in the book seem deconstructionist, such as the unstable nature of identity. For example, Alex says that he's lived long enough to acknowledge the incoherence of what used to be considered the individual self.
Oh, yes, that's a very much a Paul de Man line or an Axel van der line. Poor Alex doesn't even realize he's a deconstructionist. This is another nice joke. yes, I mean, I do find the self... I've always found the self to be unstable. I'm not even sure there is a self. I think there's a concatenation of selves. As Eliot says, you put on a face to meet the faces that you meet. So I don't feel that there is an I in there. I feel there's a series of eyes all clashing and making up a sort of a mishmash which comes out as some kind of personality. I mean, that makes us far more interesting than being merely monisms, you know, one particular self. To be a collection of selves seems to me to make life far more interesting.
Well, we often think of ourselves as being a certain way. Others perceive us quite differently.
Well, we have to think of ourselves as being... I mean, even I, skeptic that I am, I have to believe that there is a sort of pilot light burning in me somewhere that is I.
Well, although you've said that you prefer writing in the first person because you're an egomaniac.
Yes, but I think all novelists are egomaniacs. You have to be.
Because you're creating a world.
Yeah. Well, that's a very grand way of putting it. But one is making little paper people. And making them walk about in the world.
You bring up the what would seem to be the opposing point of view to deconstructionism, romanticism. Alex talks about Shelley, for instance, who was working on a poem called The Triumph of Life about dying in a shipwreck off the Italian coast. And de Man criticized the romantics' ideas of the unity and wholeness of identity.
Yes, I mean, I find that argument still between romanticism and whatever has come after romanticism. I'm not sure it's deconstruction. But the Romantics took a particular attitude to the world. They struck a pose which claimed wholeness and unity. And people like Paul de Man say, there's no such thing as wholeness, there's no such thing as unity, and a good thing too. And I'm caught between the two, because when I, in my teenage years, I read the Romantic poets with absolute passion and love. Keats was my great poet when I was 12, 13, 14. And I still...
Not a bad person.
Not a bad
to
person.
Admire
to, yes,
at any age.
Yes, a wonderful, wonderful poet. And, you know, Shelley was a very great poet. But, of course, one has to have certain ambiguous feelings about their attitude to the world.
You have an obvious affection for obscure words like mephitic, streal, scumbled, horrent, tundish, caducus, dimming, concumbrance. I don't remember consulting a dictionary as much while reading a novel since I read Aldous Huxley's Antic Hay, which is also about somebody who presents himself as being another person.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether you
but
know
I hope
that
you,
book.
I hope, yes, I do. I hope you enjoyed consulting the dictionary. I like sending people to the dictionary. Is one of the great, great inventions of human beings, of humankind. We made this extraordinary book that contains everything that expresses us. One should go to the dictionary more often.
Mm-hmm. Well, those words...
And also, I love these words because, first of all, they're accurate.
Mm-hmm.
Caducus is an absolutely accurate word. It means the early falling of leaves. It's in Emerson, by the way. I got it from Emerson. You know, people forget that, you know, I had to look in a dictionary at some point. I wasn't born with these words in my mind.
I thought that it was just a good Irish education.
Well, yes, Irish education is very good. And we, since we have a very strained relationship with the English language, even still, I think that we are constantly fascinated by the English language and constantly examining it and probing it.
Do you think it's the reason that Ireland has produced so many great stylists? Joyce, Beckett. Usually when you talk to an Irish writer, you refer to them a lot more than you do to Nabokov. But do you see yourself as coming out of that tradition as well?
Oh, yes, of course. I mean, the strange thing that happened in Ireland is that basic English was imposed on an Irish-speaking people. And the Irish language is entirely different to basic English. The two couldn't be farther apart. And the resulting strain produced what we call Hiberno-English, a marvelous literary language to work in, marvelously rich, full of ambiguities, full of echoes, full of strain. I mean, I can't imagine a better language to write in.
When you began this trilogy, Eclipse and Shroud, did you see this as part of a trilogy?
No,
or
not at
each,
all.
Each of these things were standalones in your head?
Not at all. In fact, it was only when I'd finished Ancient Light and it came out and people started talking about a trilogy that I thought, oh, yeah, I suppose it is.
Well, the Cleaves are in all of them.
I know, but you see, I never think in those terms. Books, making a book is an organic process. It grows out of other books as well as out of life. And one is never aware of a point at which it starts. You know, I always seem to be working on a book. I can't remember. There must have been a moment when I had the first idea or put down the first word, but I can never remember that. It just seems to have been going on. It's a continuing process.
And somebody like Alexander Cleve remains in the back of your head. Is that why you returned to him?
I can't remember why I returned to him. I really can't.
So you don't know whether you'll do a fourth book?
With him? I might. I don't know. It will depend on necessity. I might wake up some morning and find that I'm working on a fourth book about Alex Cleve. I hope not, really.
But you probably would be writing it without an idea of who this person was until at a certain point he declared himself to be Alex Cleve or somebody else.
I don't think it works that way. I'm not sure, but I don't think it works. I think it's usually... If I can put it this way, it's specific without my knowing. If something can be specific without one's knowledge. If I were to write a fourth book, it would probably be about Cass Cleve, Alex's daughter, who fascinates me.
This book, the latest novel by John Banville, under your own name, or do we count the Benjamin Blacks as part of the 16?
I don't know. I never keep count. It seems so shameful. So many books.
This one is called Ancient Light. It is published by Knopf. What a great pleasure it is to have you on our show.
Lovely to be back.